Mini episode 525 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.info.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Welcome, everybody. This is the Royal Rumble Anthology. Kyle Ross has had one of these in the FDH Lounge for WrestleMania and for SummerSlam. And today, I, Rick Morris, am here with Kyle Ross, FDH Lounge dignitaries both, to kick off the Royal Rumble Anthology. We're going to give it the Ken Burns treatment, as we did again, WrestleMania and SummerSlam, starting today with 1A in the series, because part one of the series is 88 to 92. 1A would, of course, out of that be 1988. My rudimentary grasp of math tells me. So, Kyle, you're the one that decided to pull the trigger on this series. So, share with us, please, your thoughts on going ahead with this, your thoughts on approach, and anything else relevant.
Well, it just seemed logical, being that we just had the Royal Rumble happen.
Okay.
And, you know, rather than go at the speed of light to get it done in time,
right,
for the 2015 Royal Rumble, because who knows when the heck anyone's listening to this, I decided, let's take our time. Let's go through like we've done for WrestleMania, like we've done through SummerSlam, and give this thing the proper treatment. Now, we're calling this first part 88 to 92. At least
yep.
I am. You can
yes.
call it whatever the hell you want, quite frankly.
You
I'm
are.
I'm calling it the best, or pardon me, the beginning to the best.
Okay.
So that should be a little bit of a spoiler alert.
Okay.
On which Rumble we think is the best. But
yes.
In breaking down the Rumbles, and I think, if at least with these early ones in particular,
mm-hmm.
this first part, we're going to be focusing primarily on the Rumble.
Yes.
Itself. The Rumble match. The undercards were, for the most part, kind of non-existent. They were just there because pay-per-views were 3 hours, and you can't drag the entire Rumble over 3 hours.
Right.
But we'll be looking at the, you know, the pertinent undercard matches as we move through this. I'll be giving my opinions on which ones I thought were the best. You know, the best non-Rumble matches, the best Rumble matches,
mm-hmm.
and most importantly, why. And we'll have some fun along the way debating these.
I have some brief notes on all of these as well, and we'll be getting into that for what we have. As far as the origins of the Royal Rumble itself, the first one that they ever had, I think this was a test deal because at this point they probably knew they were going to do this on the USA Network. October 4th, 1987 in St. Louis, untelevised, won by the one-man gang before only 1,976 people in a top-five wrestling city for decades. That shows you how much St. Louis had fallen on its ass by the fall of 87. So, one-man gang wins this. By this point in time, they surely had the plans underway. This was part of the larger competition between the WWF and the NWA at the time. They were going to be counter-programming Starrcade with the Survivor Series that year. And then, subsequently, the Royal Rumble was on USA in 88 to counter-program the NWA's Bunkhouse Stampede.
Yeah, and we had seen actually earlier in 1987 at some house shows and this stuff. You know, I had actually never seen that. I've still to this day never seen that first Rumble that you just spoke of.
I don't know if it.
I don't
it's
think
like
it exists.
Fan cam footage at best. Yeah.
And it's something that, you know, I mean, generally given how much I've seen, it's something that, you know, I can't say I've really looked for it, I guess. But
right.
Who knows? Let me know if it's out there.
Not exactly a hidden gem.
Okay. But, you know, they had done some trial runs for Survivor Series matches in the early part of the year. This was before WrestleMania. I don't know if you ever seen it. Some house shows in the Boston Garden, Madison Square Garden.
Okay.
I think for Piper's, what was Bill, this is MSG farewell. Wink, wink. There was a match with, you know, he and Hogan were on the same side.
Okay.
There was one where, you know, it was Piper, I think like Billy Jack Haynes and Ricky Steamboat against Adonis, Hercules, and Savage or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So trial runs, you know, I just bring that up because, you know, trial runs are necessary when you are, you know, getting set to create this big event.
Right.
This gimmicked pay-per-view. Pat Patterson is the one who's credited with coming up with the Rumble.
And yep.
You said it, that the very first Royal Rumble, not a pay-per-view event, but a TV event live on the USA Network, which drew a monster rating, by the
yeah.
way. An absolute monster rating. A lot of those, back then, WWF didn't do huge ratings on USA, typically.
Right.
This show did. And it was done as a follow-up. You know, they had, you know, really screwed Starrcade in Thanksgiving of 87 with the Survivor Series. This was done, the Royal Rumble TV special, to annihilate the NWA's second planned pay-per-view, Bunkhouse Stampede, which is an atrocity on many fronts. Now, NWA got a little bit of retribution a couple months later when they put the very first Clash of the Champions on free TV opposite WrestleMania 4.
Yes.
They had the better show, but...
As they did for Clash of the Champions the next year as well. Raging
yeah,
Cage
but by then,
the
pay-per-view companies actually got mad at them for doing that.
And that was the last time that
yeah,
happened.
They had the better show, but WrestleMania 5 did a gigantic number
well,
on pay-per-view.
The funny thing is the Bunkhouse Stampede, a Dusty Rhodes creation, you and I had talked about this off-air, something that could have never taken place in the WWF because on the face of it, okay, they're both different takes on the classic over-the-top Battle Royal feature. But the Bunkhouse Stampede, again, NWA, a very blue-collar promotion. Everybody's in there in, like, T-shirts and jeans. And Vince McMahon, and I'll give him credit for this.
Because it worked. He was right, whether anyone wants to admit he was or not.
He was right. Guys should look distinctive. They shouldn't all – you shouldn't look in the ring, see 20 guys, and to where you're squinting to see different points of differentiation between them.
Spoiler alert, that'll become an issue 20 years after this, by the way, when we talk about the more modern Rumbles.
No, you're right about that. You're right. But the way that it was put together in 88, it was a USA Network show. And stylistically, it felt to me almost like, and you can see some of them now on the WWE Network, the old MSG shows from the 70s, in terms of the match that's on last is kind of a throwaway, and it felt really weird. Vince and Jesse were not really treating this like with the urgency of a pay-per-view. It felt like just a regular TV show. But what's funny is, you talked about the monster rating it popped. It's all about what you're conditioned to expecting, because you never got star-on-star matches back in the day on TV outside of Saturday night's main event. They were once in a blue moon. This Royal Rumble card in 88 would not stack up comparably today, favorably, with a Monday Night Raw in terms of star power. It wouldn't.
I don't know.
You didn't have the champ on the show. You didn't have a lot
of the
other
top
guys.
Well, they had the big angle. They
yeah,
had the big angle.
But
what this was, and again, it's all about what was the show intended to do.
Yes.
This was not intended to be a pay-per-view quality
right.
show. The intention was, can we make the fourth of our big four, because this was the fourth of the big four. Survivor Series had already been Survivor Series had already been established.
Yep.
SummerSlam would be established in the summer of 88 as
yes.
the third pay-per-view. So the key is, all right, is this match something that people are going to be interested in? And it apparently worked.
Right.
Despite the lack of star power in the actual Rumble itself, which we'll get to momentarily.
Right.
But what this show was a setup to the setup show for WrestleMania 4.
Right.
The setup show itself being the main event,
mm-hmm.
which was their big return to primetime network TV with the Hogan-Andre rematch, which shattered all TV records for wrestling
right.
and will never be touched again. That, you know, they did the crazy finish with the Twin Hepners that led to the WrestleMania 4 tournament. But this show set that show up in that, okay, we're going to have this Rumble match and sort of the co-headlining draw was an angle of sorts with the Hogan-Andre contract signing.
Yes.
Which, you know, ended in predictable fashion with the table turned over on Hogan.
Kind of tame physicality compared to what we get today, but for that
yeah,
time...
Yeah, I mean, but back then, I mean, first yeah. of all, Andre was certainly, you know, not in his prime years by
right.
this point, and he wasn't going to, you know, choke slam Hogan through it.
Right.
That just didn't happen. I'll say this, before we get to the Rumble itself, I thought that segment was outstanding compared to the way big matches today are promoted. Outstanding.
It was.
The way, and granted the dynamic,
mm-hmm.
because it's those two, just can't be recreated today. I just don't think it can. I just don't
right.
think you're going to have two Austin and Rock, it was great, obviously. But
I was going to say, yeah, they might be
their
the next
chances,
ones.
But their yeah. chances, like, now and moving forward, and you should never say never, because who would have known that you would ever have Austin and Rock. But having two stars that big at the same time is very rare. And the way that this was drawn out over a year.
Yes.
Was, you know, again, that can't work today. You can't draw something out like with like basically three angles. You had the big Andre turning on Hogan and Piper's Pit.
Yeah.
The WrestleMania 3 match. Andre takes time off, returns at Survivor Series, wins the main event, attacks Hogan on Saturday Night's main event, and then you have this.
Are there not at least some similarities to the 2011-2012 Triple H Undertaker series of where?
That's
you're
true.
Setting up
okay,
for the next
I guess
year. That
I guess,
was that was some modern long term.
And
planning.
Even Michael's Undertaker.
Michael's
before
Undertaker.
That. You're right. You're
yeah.
right.
So they've
okay.
done it a little
guess,
bit. A
yeah,
little
I guess
bit.
They have.
Not,
I guess
not,
they have.
Not too much.
Not as famously as this. There are just a couple of things. I don't know if you caught this watching the show. You probably didn't. Only I told you I'd try to stay away from nuance as much as I could, but I caught this when I rewatched
got something
the show.
I know you didn't see, but you tell me first. You tell me.
Is it Hogan Zubaz?
No,
because
no.
I don't, what the hell was he wearing in this segment?
No, what it is, and
was it the parent giving his kid a backbreaker, a Rick Rude-style backbreaker in the crowd, something that would have him arrested today?
No, I didn't catch that, but that's
go
awesome.
Back, I believe it's right before they introduce them for the contract
okay.
signing. Go back. The dad, I'm assuming it's a dad's son, picks his kid up and holds him like this and starts giving him a backbreaker in the crowd while the
wow.
kid's smiling. I'm telling you, he does it today. He's probably arrested. He's throwing
probably.
Jail.
Oh, I got to go back and watch
I
that.
I don't know if it was Adrian Peterson, by the way.
If it wasn't, it should have been. The thing that I noticed was it's more so along the lines of what you were saying about the main event in February. It would take them 8 years from here, 88 to 96, to where they would get in the modern format of Royal Rumble, February pay-per-view, then WrestleMania. This was a prototype of the formula to come of setting up the road to WrestleMania.
Which
the
we know that, now. Which,
yes.
And I'm glad you brought that up.
Okay.
Because I'm going to maybe this won't be till the very end until we talk about the most recent WrestleManias.
Okay.
Has the road to WrestleMania gotten too formulaic? Now,
I think we would all agree that it has.
Okay.
You know, right, what did you notice before we get into this? What was the thing you noticed that you didn't, or was it the
oh,
backbreaker?
It was the parent
the
giving his son
oh.
the backbreaker. It made me laugh because I was like, is that dad like giving his kid a backbreaker? The crowd, I'm like, my God.
That's the greatest thing ever.
I want to talk about just evaluating these rumbles and the things
sure.
that you're looking for. One is star power. I think it, more than any other match, well, I shouldn't say that. Any main event needs star power.
Yes.
But the Rumbles generally that are the best are the ones that have the most star power.
Yes.
The early ones are okay, although it's funny that we had already sort of passed the peak years of this period
mm-hmm.
when the Rumble was starting. But you still had some big names. The lack of star power will become very evident and a huge problem in the mid-90s when we get to part two, which
yes.
I will call the down years. Thank you very much.
Yes.
Very creative. So star power matters in this. You know, you don't want a lot of Skinners in there or
no.
Repo Mans
no.
or, you know,
or Bushwhackers, but they tortured us with those guys.
And I want to throw some modern guys in there too, or Curtis Axels and stuff like that. You don't want a lot of guys. Rumbles do better when there are just more potential winners in the fans' eyes. Even if like
right.
the smarter people know it can realistically only be like three or four.
Right.
You know, when there are more over guys in a match, the Rumble's obviously better. The winner of the Rumble, did the right guy win?
Right.
That's something that matters, I think,
yeah.
that we'll talk about. There's one I know that I'm sure we're going to go back and forth on. We'll probably, and a lot of people scratch their heads when they look at it retrospect here early on. And then just the individual and creative booking of the matches. You know, what were the nuances? What were the most memorable parts of this Rumble? Every Rumble, I shouldn't say every Rumble because some of them didn't have anything interesting, but cough 2015. But, you know, certain Rumbles, you know, when you go back to the older ones, the first time you saw something, you're like, oh, this became a trademark of the Rumble. So what were the
right?
What were the kind of most creative, if there were, aspects that, you know, made the individual Rumbles unique? So that's what I'm looking
for. Sure.
That's what I look for going through these.
Okay. And then I have a handful of notes on the undercard. And other segments for these matches. The first couple of ones in particular, it started with the 88 one being on TV. They all were distinguished by having segments in there that were to set up feuds or whatever. One of the segments, or maybe we should just get to it from 88 before we get into the matches. I don't know what it was intended to set up other than the strongman gimmick. Dino Bravo's weightlifting segment, where he ostensibly set a world record, but with Jesse Ventura's help, which Vince McMahon himself later in the show called boring. And I didn't know if that was a meta moment of where he realized that was a stupid, boring, piss break of a moment, or if Vince was just playing along in character.
You know what's funny? It was kind of dumb, like, oh, here's this strong guy.
It dragged out.
It really was long.
Yes.
But you know what? The end result of that gimmick, it sort of was his thing for the longest time. Like, it's funny how, and I don't know if this is just because you have the nostalgic glasses on when you go back and look at this stuff. It's funny how certain angles or what have you just stuck back then, like, and were more memorable. Like,
right.
You're right, this was, like, it's like, Jesus, just, you know.
Oh, it was
like,
interminable.
But, like, get to the point where Jesse just helps him up. And it's a kind of a dumb thing where it's like, okay, here's a guy calling himself the strongest man, but he cheated to set a fake bench press record. I guess, whatever. I mean, but it stuck with him. And, you know, Dino Bravo was a guy who I always thought was pushed more, wasn't as over as his push, is what I'm trying to say.
I think that's true.
But, you know, this was, like, honestly, like, this was kind of, like, his thing. He had just broken away, remember, and was first going solo when he did this. He had just the very ill-fated New Dream Team with him and Greg Valentine did not last. So, yeah, he had that. You know, that's something you talk about Monday Night Raw. This is something that would go on Monday Night Raw today.
Oh,
you would never
would.
Put this on a major show, and granted, God, if that was on the way it drew out, if this was on Monday Night Raw today, holy God almighty.
Oh, the quarter hour segment would be brutal. This one, like you talk about not as over as his push, and I agree, but he had so few memorable feuds or anything like that.
Well,
it was
always based, you know, I mean, he was kind of
high
on the mid card in by late 88. He was a co-captain.
Yeah.
You know, he had that feud with Jim Duggan. Both guys, look, I'm not going to claim I'm a member of either of their fan club, but both were pushed high. And, you know, even going into, like, 90, Bravo was kept fairly strong. Remember, he feuded with the Ultimate Warrior.
And kept with the Earthquake, so that
that
helped.
I don't know. I mean, look, it was.
Let me ask you this. Do you suppose there was any part of this segment that was a rib in the sense of at the almost same point in time, they were doing the weightlifting thing in the NWA that set up the feud with the Road Warriors and the Powers of Pain? Was it any kind of a rib that they were... Okay, just a coincidence?
No, I just think that, you know, it was just bench pressing. And,
okay.
Yeah.
Then there was a lot of focus on that in early 88 for some reason. It was the height of the steroid era, but
I think you just don't see it anymore because it's so obvious what's going to happen.
Yeah.
I mean, Triple H, remember when Triple H and Scott Steiner, they did that really 80s build-up? Remember, weren't they doing like a pose down? That didn't get over very well.
No, it didn't. When we get to 89, we're going to have some more pose-down garbage to talk about. But on this one, the first match ever on a Royal Rumble card was between two guys who would go on to have a pretty good feud in WCW, Ravishing Rick Rude and Ricky the Dragon Steamboat. I have to say, and this is just my opinion looking back on stuff, these are guys that I have a lot of regard for them individually, more so Steamboat than Rude, as most people do. Boy, I never felt like the whole was greater than the sum of the parts of these guys. They just never, to me, had the kind of matches, maybe in WCW, but this one here, I'm sitting there going, yeah, I expect more.
Well, Steamboat was on his way out that period.
I got to tell
you. And Rude just wasn't very good at that point. Rude,
I think that's
I have made this case a lot of times. Rick Rude is the rare case of a name WWF guy going to WCW and actually having a better run there. Pre-NWO WCW.
Better quality anyways. But, I mean, Rude and Bull were a heck of a tag team. Was that all Manny Fernandez? I mean, that's...
I don't know.
I don't know. I think you're right. I think he wasn't as good of a worker then. Here's a funny thing, though. You mentioned about Steamboat on his way out. Steamboat was protected here because, again, back in the day, clean finishes on TV, they were loath to do those. It ends up being a DQ finish for Rude here. Meanwhile, Steamboat gives, gets fired, essentially, right about the time of WrestleMania 4 because he asks for time off to be home with his son.
No, that had already happened. I think he was just, He might have wanted more time, but that's why they took the Intercontinental title off him, was at first, was because the birth of the son.
Well, but there was a second go-around of where around the time of WrestleMania 4, and that's my point. Vince didn't know he was going to fire Steamboat because it would have been a clean job for Steamboat here if he'd have known that. Steamboat was protected for no good reason.
Yeah, plus he was the babyface and was the opener.
Yeah, the women's tag match, I would say better than anything non-NXT that you would see today.
The Jumping Bomb Angels were a very curious Vince McMahon hire. It seemed that they were so out of place. They got over at the first Survivor Series, and this was a title change here over the Jimmy Hart-managed Glamour Girls.
Yeah.
And I'll be honest with you, this match actually got over. Women's wrestling was always has always been treated as a piss break, let's be honest.
Right.
This match got over. And these two teams actually had some other good matches, too. I think from that era, the post, you know, enhancement era that we got used to in the Attitude Era, other women's match was ever as over as this stuff.
Here's the funny thing about youthful lenses, though. Of what I remember of the Jumping Bomb Angels versus watching this match, I remember them as being like a more advanced British Bulldogs. They weren't. They were very good. I were watching this match. Had I not had the thing in my head of them being like the greatest women's workers of all time by far, I wouldn't have been, I wouldn't say disappointed with it, but like they were very good. They just didn't live up to my childhood memories, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I mean, again, I mean, with moves,
not
I mean,
quite,
no,
not
no
quite
one
childhood.
Had, I mean,
late adolescence, not childhood.
Yeah, I mean, nothing really will. I mean, if you're basing, like, you know, move set off what you see today, I mean, you're always going to be disappointed looking
exactly.
back.
Exactly, and I didn't expect that to be the case. The Hogan-Andre signing, we talked about that. After the match, or after the Royal Rumble match, Wikipedia called this the main event. Because it went on last. Islanders versus the Stallions. A questionable choice for a 2 out of 3 falls match, I thought, because the Stallions were pure jobbers to the Stars.
Well, you know, they got to have that brief kind of thing. I think they beat the Hearts in a non-title match late 87. But I'll say this. The reason this went on last is because had the Rumble gone longer, it just would have been cut anyway, and they probably would have just done it for the last. I'm assuming it was just the very definition of time filler. It's like, okay, the Rumble's over, and we still have TV time left. Let's send the Young Stallions and the Islanders out there to do that.
They didn't announce it as TV time remaining, but it might as well have been.
Yeah, so. And the Islanders were getting pushed at that point.
Yeah, they went over two falls.
I'm not going to, you know, cry a river for them. The Islanders kind of got – I thought that they were possibly deserving – just because there's so few over teams in today's wrestling, they were probably deserving of a run with the tag titles. Now, we know that, you know, Strikeforce was a very long transitional champion to Demolition, who got WrestleMania 4. But it was funny that Strikeforce was kind of feuding with the Islanders. They worked against each other a lot on the house shows during this period.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know – had Demolition already not been earmarked to win the belts, I would have not have been surprised if there was some talk about the Islanders getting them.
Well, and this makes a great segue to talking about the Royal Rumble match itself, because they were, as was referenced during their match with the Stallions, at this point in a feud with the Bulldogs, the Matilda angle that we all know and love.
Oh, boy, that
so
was not good.
So here's the thing, and this when we talk about the star power of the 88 Rumble and how it was basically a mid-card match.
It was a mid-card match.
But it goes beyond, okay, Roode and Steamboat were in the opener. Hogan and Andre were doing their segment. It goes beyond that. Not on the card at all. Savage, Honky, Bulldogs, Demolition. A lot of significant names not in the match. And it was only 20 guys to boot. So you were really scraping the bottom of the barrel.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, look, I have the words mid-card match in my notes right here. And I have no Hogan, Andre, Savage, you guys going. But again, this was not – you know, this is the only one where that's an issue because it's a TV one.
Right.
You know, they were, I think, literally just like, all right, what is – and it's funny because back then they kind of gave you – as little as they could.
Yeah, what's the least we can do to put a dent in the Bunkhouse Stampede?
But at the same time, they always did a better job back then, and I will say this, and feel of getting you to want a little more than now, where it's kind of like, okay, that was really good, but, you know, how are they going to follow this up, and am I even interested?
Right.
So, look, this Rumble is very forgettable. I mean, it's almost erased from history, to be honest with you. They almost never talked about it. And the goal, though, was, I think, again, I've said this two or three times already, will this match get over for a live crowd? And the answer is it did. It did. I think Ventura referenced it at some point fairly early. He's like, this is a really interesting match. And you could tell because, I think the, here's a blat name from the past, Scott Keith once called the Royal Rumble a battle royal for people with ADHD. In that it's something, there's always a new guy coming out, then it's something kind of happening. And we know now that this has become the company's number two pay-per-view.
Yeah.
It's funny. We'll talk about this as we move through the years, when exactly that came about.
Right.
You didn't know it would be that big at this point, but I think you did. Like, the only positive I'll say about this Rumble is that afterwards you're like, I would like to see that match again.
Here's the
and
funny thing.
And that was
thing.
The goal.
You know, and Scott Keith, I can't believe I'm saying this, makes an interesting point. But here's the thing, though. And the advantage that this had over the Stampede and subsequent things like World War III with 60 guys in, Battle Royals themselves are inherently, in my opinion, uninteresting because you can't focus on everything that's happening.
And like, everyone just phones it in.
Yeah.
Like, Battle Royal, you get 20 guys in there, and they just lay on the thing.
Yeah.
And here's the thing, too, and this is a big thing with Rumbles for me.
Mm-hmm.
Some of these have fallen in that pattern. When there's too many guys in the ring, I think when there's like 6 to 8, there's a drinking game you can play with the Royal Rumble.
Right.
And I always say it's always good with 6 to 8 people where it's like you draw a number, that's your guy. When he gets thrown out, you gotta do a shot or you gotta chug your beer.
Exactly.
And then you get the next guy. I remember the one year, and this was obviously not 1988 because my parents would have been arrested, but when we were playing the game, and I remember the one, I was like, dude, there's like 12 guys in, and there's like 4 guys unaccounted for that we're gonna have to go to. That's too many. But yeah, I just wanted to mention that.
That is pretty funny. Well, we talk about the star power or lack thereof. We mentioned the guys not in the match. It's equally worth mentioning some of the guys who were, because they were, for the most part, not on the landscape at this point. Sam Houston, Ron Bass, who later that year would get his cup of coffee with Brutus Beefcake in that feud, the only thing he ever did up there. The Killer Bees, the Bolsheviks. This is what we're talking about for this year.
Was that thing they did, too, in this? I don't know if you made a note of this at all. Was, like, the Nikolai Volk, he, like, ran out early, and they just, like, they kept calling him an idiot?
I think so. I remember something like that.
Remember
that?
No, I mean, they did, and it was, like, I don't know if that was, like, if he just screwed up, or if they, like, if they wanted to just, like, make Nikolai Volkov look like an idiot. I don't know.
Well, and we're going to talk about this as well, that, you know, It took several years to where it got to the format that we understand right now of where you get the entrance music when the guys are coming in. There was none of that. That year, there was just a countdown screen on the TV. I don't even think the crowd was doing the whole 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 thing.
Yeah,
they weren't
either.
Conditioned.
And first, here's the thing, too. The first two guys in the match, Bret Hart and Tito Santana.
Yes.
In the ring together. They were just out, like, they came back from a commercial break, and they were just like, here are the guys who drew 1 and 2. Thank God they don't do that anymore.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And that was, and again, you know, Bret, number one in the history of the Royal Rumble, and the first Iron Man. This would be a trope that we would be getting into in the years ahead, of somebody going long in the match. And ideally, that and what we would come to call the diesel spot after 94, tossing out a lot of guys. Those are the things to help get guys over for future pushes. In this case, I think not a coincidence. Bret, this was a couple months before they started the breakaway angle from Jimmy Hart, the start of a little bit of a singles push in
88. Didn't go anywhere.
Didn't go anywhere.
It was the first of two start and stop singles push, because they did it in 89, too.
Yes, they did. Yes, they did. So Bret, in this match, got that opportunity. This was the only Rumble I think we've talked about, or maybe we haven't. It was only 20 men. I think we mentioned that. The only one that didn't go to 30. And, again, it was always weird to me, the eventual winner of the thing here, spoiler alert for anybody that didn't watch it, and if you're not wanting to be spoiled on the 88 Rumble, no offense,
people,
but why are you?
I think anyone who listens to a wrestling podcast generally knows who wins these matches.
Okay, yeah. We shouldn't even have to say that at this point. I wondered at the time, back then, Hacksaw Jim Duggan, what? I mean,
he was very over.
He was an upper mid-card face his entire run there. He was not even as low as regular mid-card until, like, much later. So I get it in that sense, but watching the match, it makes perfect sense because particularly if you get the sense they were going to go with a face to win this, the only upper mid-card faces in the whole thing were him and Jake Roberts. It was a two-man show in that regard.
I wrote it down that the only other guy you probably could have put over here, because they were going to put a baby face over, was Jake the Snake Roberts. And he was put in early. Didn't do much. Jake Roberts, by the way, always kind of sucked in Rumbles.
Yeah.
We'll see that. Well, I guess, like, you know, he always was thrown out kind of quick.
I always liked the short-arm clothesline spot.
It was weird. He would always come in, get really over.
Yeah.
And then, like, you'd get tossed pretty quick. Like, it was it was pretty funny.
You're right about that. Now, the funny thing is, there was a guy in this who would go on to become the biggest name out of any of them. The Ultimate Warrior, but this was about 6 months into his run.
And he wasn't very over.
No,
like,
he wasn't.
I don't even think. Did he even like run down the ring?
I don't think
no. It was kind of a brisk jog, I believe.
Yeah,
but he didn't do the whole thing, and the music didn't play,
right?
Which was a big thing. You're right. Yeah, because he comes out towards the end. You're like, oh, here's a guy, and I think he was throwing out little fanfare, and
right.
You know, Junkyard Dog was nearing the end. Too. He had clearly morphed into Junk Food Dog by this point.
Yeah, well, and Don Morocco being another guy like that.
No,
I never
liked him as a face. He didn't like himself as a face, by the way.
I
gave an interview. He said he never really liked that run.
Hearing him constantly referred to in this match as
the Rock. Yeah,
it's
always kind of weird.
It's jarring.
Yeah,
like, it really is. Well, and here's the other thing, too, and I'll say this about Doug, and I said this to you off air. I never really understood the whole thing before, and I think it's a bad rap. In the modern parlance, when they're using it to talk about Daniel Bryan, you know, is he over or is his chant or whatever over?
Oh, I think it's an outstanding talking point.
It's ridiculous in the context of Daniel Bryan. Daniel Bryan is over, at least when he's not dealing with some of the crappy booking that he gets. But
liberal excuses.
But here's the thing. Jim Duggan, watching this in retrospect, I finally understand the question. Because there's no question whatsoever that ho and USA was way more over than he was. It helped get him over, so you could question whether it's the chicken or the egg.
No, here's the thing. I mean,
the Pavlovian response. He got massive pops every one of these early Royal Rumbles. It's
didn't
amazing.
I reference one of our old WrestleMania anthologies too, comparing Daniel the Yes to Hacksaw Jim
Duggan.
I think I did. I'm pretty sure I did. And it's funny because you're right. We've seen other guys try to get over with USA.
Right.
Duggan made it work a little better than I think, you know, replacement level. He was a little above replacement level, to borrow a baseball term.
He was.
But it's something that, like, you know, someone else could have done.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, he basically was the guy who finally replaced Sergeant Slaughter when they fired him in the mid-80s.
Yes.
You know, as kind of that, like, you know, he was never as over as Slaughter was at Slaughter's peak. I mean, Duggan never drew big houses to MSG.
Right.
But, you know, he was better than, like, you know, Corporal Kirchner.
Right. Oh, that's true. That's true. And I think they learned their lesson after Corporal Kirchner, and that was do the gimmick but retire the whole military thing with it.
Mm-hmm.
And they never billed Duggan at all as having a military background.
A couple things here. One, there were very few feuds teased. Duggan Race, which kind of really didn't go anywhere. It kind of fizzled out. They had
right.
You know, they had done some stuff on Superstars before this, and there was never really a conclusion that I recall in that feud.
No, not really.
And there was the very sad Sam Houston, Danny Davis Superstars feud that was referenced. But other than that, there wasn't a lot of feuds teased in this, and that's a big part of Rumbles is like guys who are feuding somehow to integrate that feud into the match. So that hurt the thing. And what I always what stuck out to me, and this was with the announcing, is they really didn't put over every man for himself as much as they would really build that the next year for the pay per view. It's every man for himself, but they really were stressing the face heel dynamic here. And, like, Ventura kept talking, whenever a guy would come out, at least early in the match, he's like, oh, this is another guy for that team. You know, like, he'd be like, you know, like, Butch Reed and Bret Hart were beating down on Tito Santana or something like that.
Yes.
And I think another heel came out, and it was just like, oh, well, that's trouble for Tito.
Right.
And then a face came out. He's like, oh, well, it was just.
You're right.
The face-heel dynamic was so clearly defined back then.
Yeah.
Now no one thinks about it at all. And in the early ones, it was still there. Even, you know.
You're right.
But here it was just so expected. It was like a baby face will help we'll all work together, and it's almost kind of like a team thing, you know, where no baby face will throw over another baby face.
Right.
No heel will throw over another heel. To be honest, I can't remember if you had that happen. In 89, I know you did.
You would have spots of that, particularly, I would say, earlier in the matches on the next couple of ones of where the heels would stick together, sometimes the faces would. But you're right. It would never be as clear again as it was in 88. You're right about that. And, again, the way that this played out, you had a little bit of one of the things that we would see subsequently in Royal Rumbles to come, borrowing from the classic timeless Battle Royal trope, with Andre the Giant allegedly having won more Battle Royals than anybody out there. The big guy, the giant that people struggle to get out of the ring. And this one, the one-man gang, was the resident monster who cleared out a lot of guys later in the match. He ends up being the second guy left in there. And Duggan throws him out to win the match.
Yeah, it was Duggan. It came down to Duggan against Dino Bravo.
Yeah.
And One Man Gang. And I'll say this, say what you will, man. Jim Duggan was a lot more over in that role than Roman Reigns was in 2015.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, the crowd wanted the babyface to overcome the odds in that situation.
Also, this was being held in Hamilton, Ontario, and Jesse Ventura, I believe, wondered at one point why the crowd was chanting USA. That was kind of funny.
Oh, I agreed that. It was funny. And, like, it was because, like, Duggan would do that in Canada.
Yeah.
He did it multiple times.
Yeah.
And it, like, it worked. Now he would be, like, booed out of the building, probably.
9 years later, he would have been the biggest heel in the world, trying that in the midst of the USA Canada.
It's too bad he was under contract to WCW in 1997, because they absolutely should have brought him back.
That would have been outstanding. But, it was... It definitely had a different feel with being on USA. I think we would agree with that.
Yeah, like I have in here, you couldn't have guessed that it would become the company's number two pay-per-view, but you would have guessed, like I said, it's a show that, or a match, I should say, a match that you wanted to see again.
Yeah.
And is this the best one? No, it's not even close. To be honest, I don't even rank it because it's not the same thing. It's 20 guys.
Okay.
So if I were to... It's obviously among the worst ones.
And I don't know on any of these ones here. I don't know if you're going to do snowflakes on all of them. I'll try. I'm saying 2 stars right on the button. Is that right?
I can give you a general area. Yeah.
Okay.
I would say that. I mean, it's anything below 2 is bad, and this can't be bad because if it was bad, then we probably would not be doing a Royal Rumble anthology. So 2 stars sounds about right.
Yeah, and part of it is, too, the novelty factor of it as well. If you try to watch it through the eyes of people in 88 who had never seen this before, that adds a little bit of intrigue.
Yeah, if you're a newer fan who's never seen this, you're absolutely going to be unimpressed by this.
Right.
But, and look, the number of Rumbles below 2 stars are very few. There are only a few bad Rumbles. It's a match that's very hard to screw up,
which
I think this
proves. We have one
of
them coming up in part one, in my estimation anyways. I'll rank
one
of them below 2 stars.
I think it's close. I know which one it is, okay. but I don't have it in the bad category.
Okay.
Actually. I have it in the subpar category.
All right. So 88 essentially birthed the modern world, if you will, as it comes to Royal Rumbles. Anything else to say about this one, Kyle?
No. I think we've pretty much summed it all up, to be honest with you. Mid-card match, the setup show to WrestleMania 4, and... not a lot of star power, but overall, I guess it's a successful show.
Pretty good show. And this one, like all of these, of course, can be found on the WWE Network. That was where I had to go do this. Kyle, it's interesting you didn't have to do that to watch all these. You've watched enough of these.
Yeah, I probably watched most of these old ones enough times where I can just go by memory. I actually did rewatch this one,
which is why I knew
about the backbreaker. I haven't seen this that many times.
Okay. All right. Well, it was basically a decently interesting show, but there certainly will be better
ones
to
come. Not in the modern sense.
Yeah, not in the modern sense, and there will be better ones to come, particularly as we continue progressing through part one of the Royal Rumble anthology.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, All Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Awkwafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.